In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Politically Georgia podcast, where we bring you news and analysis from all the latest Georgia shenanigans in Congress and under the Gold Dome. And today we're joined by James Salzer to talk about the end of what is it, weird, bizarre, I don't know how you call it, but James, you wrote that you've covered every legislative session in Georgia since 1990, and this was by far not only the longest, but also the weirdest.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question, and I was, to make sure it wasn't just my, you know, kind of viewpoint as a reporter, I talked to a lot of long-time people who have been there much longer than I have, and they all said the same thing. It was kind of interesting because that was the first words out of most people's mouths when this started a couple of weeks ago when the session restarted was, this is just weird. And there was so many little things about it that were strange that it'd be interesting because it really was a trial run, because I think they'll, if there's still, bad pandemic going on in January, they'll make some changes, but there'll be similar limits, I would think.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird session when the House Speaker David Ralston tells everyone not to rip up paper, you know, as the annual tradition of throwing shredded paper like confetti in the air to mark the end of the session, when he tells them not to do that because they want to limit exposure to janitors, and instead they have a much quieter celebration. It was a very muted sine die, but one that, you know, a lot of major things happened, and we'll get into it. I mean, James, what was your standout moment from this session?
I mean, the two biggies, obviously, and they were kind of going to be the biggies from day one, and from the moment almost this session restarted, was passage of the hate crimes, which, the Senate Republicans messed around a bit with it the first week. And it looked like it wasn't going to happen. I mean, they looked like they put poison pill into it so it wouldn't happen. And within, the couple of days, it was on the fast track to pass. And then, obviously, the money issues, which I assume will be continuing for actually a couple of years with the recession, that turned out, I think, better than at least people in state government thought it would.
Yeah, they weren't as drastic as first, first conceived. And even the 14% cuts were shrunk to about 10% cuts when it was all said and done. But still, that took $250 million of rainy day fund reserves that the Governor Deal, when he was in office, was very reluctant to ever tap into. Governor Kemp said, if there's ever a time to use these rainy day funds, it's right now.
Yeah, I know Governor Kemp has this in the back of his mind, and his people do, and so do the House and Senate budget writers. Is, they can't empty that this upcoming fiscal year, because in the next fiscal year, there are projections that they're going to have to cut some more. So, you don't want to. What happened in the Great Recession is they emptied it, pretty much emptied in like 6 months. They just had like no other way of doing it. They used both. It was actually two reserves they used. They used that reserve, and the other reserve they used, which was kind of surprising, I thought, was they were willing to cut basic K-12 funding $950 million. But it was made a lot easier by the fact that school districts around the state have been, not everyone, but a lot of them have been piling up reserves. So they actually, if you count up all the money that's in school district reserves around the state, it's actually a larger amount of money than the state has in reserves. So I think they were, the budget writers looked at it and said, we don't want to, cut education if we don't have to, but they have this pool that they can use to kind of mitigate those cuts, which is kind of why it wasn't as bad. I think that was huge reason why it wasn't as bad, because if they didn't have reserves, which they didn't have those kind of reserves during the recession, Great Recession, then $950 million would have been, to a lot of districts would have been catastrophic. I mean, you would have had, particularly in rural parts of the state, you would have had, and you still might have a little bit of this, but you would have had them having to shorten the school year to 170, 160 days. You would have had furloughs of teachers. You might have pay cuts of teachers. You might have layoffs. You might have programs cut. And I think the fact that so many of them have reserves, and they got a bunch of federal CARES Act money, they got $450 million, I think, in federal CARES Act money. I think that those two things kind of really softened the blow.
Yeah, it was a very interesting debate over the budget too. I mean, you've seen a lot of these budget debates, but I remember a few years ago, only a handful of Democrats would vote against the budget. One of them, I remember in 2014, one of the maybe the biggest issues of Jason Carter when he was a state senator and he was running for governor, he voted for the budget, but then was critical of Nathan Deal for signing the budget. And Deal's answer was always, well, you voted for it.
I remember that.
This time around, it was very different. You had about 60 or so Democrats in the House vote against the budget. So it's
and all the Democrats in the Senate did.
Yeah. So much more partisan lines on the budget and over another issue that you're looking at too, which was legislative pay cuts.
Right. Yeah. The difference, though, I would say in any of the budgets that Nathan Deal had versus this was that, besides this is an election year and the House Democrats desperately want to be able to gain the seats to take over. I mean, you had legitimate, even though this is not much better than it could have been. You had legitimate spending cuts, and at the same time, the Democrats were trying to say, in 2014 when Jason Carter did that, there wasn't a big decline in revenue, and there wasn't a need. Or at least an attempt to increase revenue. This time around, the Democrats and some Senate Republicans also were really pushing a cigarette tax increase. We have, I think, 48th or 49th highest cigarette taxes in the country. They wanted to, cut back on some of the special interest tax breaks. There's like $10 billion in tax breaks, throughout the state law. So they were going to have to cut spending at the same time. There was such a shutdown by the speaker and other Republicans in the House to say, we're just not going to do that. We are not in election year going to raise taxes. And that's kind of oblivious to the polling that shows 75 or 80% of people think is a good idea to raise cigarette taxes. So, but that's just, they just weren't going to do it. And I think that's why there was such consternation on that vote.
Yeah. We've talked at length about hate crimes, which is the other major initiative that passed this session. But you are also following some of those tax and audit legislation, as well as a very interesting bill that would allow the sale, the delivery of booze and alcohol. Can you talk a little bit about the path that's taken through the legislature?
That's like a 20-year, I think, development of thinking maybe in the legislature. I don't know if that's the right word to say, right way to say it. But 20 years ago, if anybody had filed the bill and as I refer to as the liquor boys, the liquor store owners, it's like 500 or 600 small liquor stores, they had such a strong lobbyist, and they had, and historically they had such a strong lobbyist, that those bills would be dead. I don't even know if they would get a hearing. They might get a hearing, but there was no way they would move. And then in 2005 or six, grocery stores started, who also have a very powerful lobbyist, started pushing this idea of allowing liquor and not liquor, but beer and wine to be sold at grocery stores on Sunday. And so there's been this progression since then. And that took 5 years. That took for essentially for us to get a new governor, because that governor, Sonny Perdue at the time, was a teetotaler who didn't, you know, who wasn't for expansion of any kind of alcohol laws. And then Nathan Deal, as soon as he got in office, you know, signed it. It got passed very quickly. But there's been a progression. There's been, you know, there's been brew pub bills. There's been all these things. And so it was interesting because Representative Harrell, who's chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, which is a tax writing committee, has pushed this for a couple of years. And when it came up in the Senate, it was interesting because Ed Harbison, who was a senator from Columbus, had tried similar bills, you know, several years ago. But the timing wasn't right. Now, I kind of wonder, although I've kind of thought this had a good shot before coronavirus, I think the pandemic shutdown just increased dramatically the desire for people to be able to have stuff delivered. One of the grocery store lobbyists was telling me that she had stores where the increase in delivery sales, that those sales had increased more than 100% in the month of April. And that kind of gave impetus to, you know, first of all, we have this idea that, you know, more and more people are getting stuff delivered to them anyways, whether they buy it on Amazon or whether they buy it in a local store. But then you had this situation where many people, myself included, did not go to the grocery store. We had stuff delivered. And so that it made it kind of, you know, I think it made it much easier to sell that argument. I think it was going to, I really think because of the way things are changing. And
oh, it's interesting. I mean, so do you think that it was set to, do you think it would clear the General Assembly if not for the pandemic?
I think it, you know, I was thinking about this at the time because it passed, if I remember correctly, it passed the House like the week of the shutdown. It might have been right before, but I think it was about the week of the shutdown. And they weren't certain. I mean, Representative Harrell certainly was not certain it was going to pass at the time. But I kind of thought it had momentum. But I think once coronavirus happened, that was it.
That's interesting, Chris, because obviously hate crimes is another bill that was doomed, it seemed, before the protest movement and before the pandemic hiatus, because the session would have ended on time. And, you know, who knows in an alternate universe what would have happened to that bill. But it looked like it was going nowhere fast before right. Before the protest and the video of Ahmaud Arbery's death.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't that definitely was not. I don't think that was going to go anywhere. I mean, I think that's an example of the timing, which makes it even more interesting. As I know you've written about this idea that, well, what's the next step on social and racial justice? You know, the platform. Is there going to be appetite next year for this? Because the timing was, you know, you couldn't to pass that bill. You couldn't have had, you know, more things happen around it that were more likely to get it passed.
Yeah, in a way, it sounds terrible, but in a way, it's a perfect storm, you know, of just tragedy and protest and uproar that forced, in particular, the Georgia Senate to make a move on it. Look, you know, we've talked a lot about that bill, but there's been, you know, it was just a very bizarre session. And I just want to get your thoughts on the environment. I mean, you were there pretty much every day of those 11 days. You were there on a Saturday when they came in just to keep the clock running, because they had to make sure, or it wasn't just to keep the clock running, because they actually did, you know, had floor debate that day. But they had to make sure that this budget was passed before July 1st and signed into law. So what was it like every single day to see some lawmakers masked, some weren't? Reporters were either in the gallery of the Senate or in the little glass box in the House, as they usually are. But what was the environment like with just fewer people? But it seemed, you know, at times tenser. At sometimes it seemed just, I don't know, surreal is the best word.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best word. I was a little bit prepared for it because I had covered the Senate Appropriations Subcommittees had been meeting live for a few weeks before the session. And so I got to see who was wearing masks, who wasn't, how it was going to be run. And it kind of ran like that during the session. But yeah, it was strange. The first day went up. So almost all the lobbyists, there was a group of conservative lobbyists who did not wear, who just didn't even look like they had masks, but everybody else had masks. There wasn't a lot of social distancing because I don't know that lobbyists know how to social distance anymore than legislators or reporters for that matter. So in the House, it mandated that you had to wear a mask. The speaker had to probably remind them every couple of days because there were Republican legislators who were wearing it around their necks and not, you know, they weren't, you know, they obviously didn't want to be wearing it. So, and they weren't going to wear it properly. And they also were, you know, going up and having the close conversations that, you know, you probably shouldn't have if you're social distancing. But there was some defiance, I think, going on. And then it was odd. The House to me was, but just much more, which much odder than the Senate, because the Senate, you not everybody was in there at the same time, but the voting was similar. You still voted a machine and it moved more quickly. But the House had certain number. They had like half the members sitting at their seats. They had another group that were in the balcony of the chamber, and then they had people in members in room 341, which is the rules and budget room, which is away. So it kind of, I think, probably muted the debate on bills. And then every bill, in every amendment, every motion that wasn't unanimous, which is most of them, they had to do a roll call vote. So that roll call could take 10 or 15 minutes. So it kind of automatically slowed down what was going on. I don't know that any, you know, changed any votes, but it did make it less likely that they would do what they do most of the time on the 38th and 39th and 40th days, which is just ram stuff through. And, you know, I think they vote like 100-150 times on the House and Senate on the 40th day or the 39th day, because they're just voting and voting and voting and, you know, very little description of what bills do. Now again, some of that did take place. I mean, there was an episode in the Senate Finance Committee where they passed a bill that cut, either eliminated or severely cut about three dozen tax breaks. Well, the bill wasn't filed that way. They just stuck this in a bill. And then they just said, you know, we're going to vote on this. Didn't let anybody in the public talk about it. Didn't give it to the public, so the public didn't actually know what they were doing, which is kind of the way it usually is. But it was weird. It was stranger than usual because usually, if you do that, there's a bunch of lobbyists in there who want to, you know, find out about it. Well, the committee meeting rooms essentially wouldn't let lobbyists or the public in. So they were doing this kind of there was a streaming video, but other than that, you didn't see what they were doing, or you wouldn't know what they were doing. And you certainly didn't, you know, the public did not have copies of what they were voting on. It was kind of in a way, in the sense that everything was streamed. There was more transparency in that way. It was more streamed than there's ever been before. But on the other hand, if you don't know what they're voting on, it's kind of, you know, useless.
Yeah, it's hard to follow the debate if you can't even see what the legislation they're talking about is. And that's another thing I want to talk to you about, because we usually do this pre-sign-you-die podcast or stories about all the shenanigans that can happen, because there's usually all sorts of big bills that are still up for debate, either the day before sign-you-die or sign-you-die itself. In this case, there still were some big issues, and there were still some shenanigans. There was just a lot of behind the surface, because me and you were getting tips all day long about things like the casino bill making maybe a last-ditch effort. There was ethics legislation that really would allow unlimited funding for different political parties and PACs and things like that. It would open the floodgates for that. And then there was this late attempt by Republican leaders to talk about rolling back citizens' arrest legislation due to the another sort of aftermath of the Ahmaud Arbery death, because that citizens' arrest statute was invoked to justify his killing, at least initially, by a prosecutor before they were overruled. So what shenanigans were you watching, and how was it different watching them from a more remote distance in some sense?
Well, the last day, which was Friday, I thought was going to be like a really, really, really dangerous day for the people of Georgia, because they had done hate crimes and they had done the budget. So they'd really done the two things that were kind of on the hot topics or the big deals. Technically the House didn't approve the budget until, late Friday, but we all knew where that was going to go. And the deal had already been struck. A budget hasn't been voted down since Oglethorpe, probably. So you kind of knew once the deal was made that was going to go through. So I think the campaign finance one you mentioned was interesting, because it wasn't completely obvious what you and I both talked about several, rumors about what the goal was, but it wasn't completely obvious what they were trying to do. I actually had a different interpretation than you did about it. But the bill on liability was interesting, because it was, from what I gather, an attempt by people who couldn't get tort reform, quote, reform, changes in the tort law through earlier in the session before coronavirus, to kind of get more legal liability, eliminate legal liability post coronavirus. So, that was a bill that, there were a few bills in the session. That was one of them where, you saw all the lobbyists underneath the TVs watching this as it was going on, because the business community really, really, really wanted this. And so that, to me, those were the one. There was a lot of rumors going on, but there were always. The other thing is we're talking about this right after the session, and we'll find out in about 2 weeks some of the stuff that they did. There's going to be stuff that we're not that they didn't snuck into bills on the last minute, probably, that we won't. It'll be a while before we find out.
And it's certainly lawmakers who were voting on them didn't know about it. At least most of them. Right. You always kind of find that where you interview lawmakers. Did you know that you voted to open the floodgates?
Oh, yeah, that's an every year thing. Although, sometimes when I hear that, I'm going like, yeah, you knew, you still want to admit it. if it's something bad that, I didn't know anything about that. I'm like, okay, yeah, I've heard that before.
So basically there were still shenanigans. They're a little harder to track than usual, and we might be seeing the repercussions of those shenanigans for weeks. Well, they will have long lasting effects, but we might not be even finding out about some of them for weeks to come.
Yeah, we weren't. I had another reporter ask me about a piece of legislation today where they said, well, this was stuck onto this. And I said, yeah, that's the 40th day is you take one bill that you can't get passed through a chamber, and then you stick it on the back end of something that, or you completely eliminate what some bill said and you just stick it in there and you try it. You're trying it over and over. So there'll be some of those that we'll see. And again, because of the way things worked, it wasn't, I think there probably was less kind of wheeling and dealing that actually got through, because you know, the campaign finance bill was an example of one that, like, you know, if it was the regular way, the thing, I mean, if it was a regular session where they just were voting on, you know, bill after bill after bill after bill, that could have gotten through. You know, people wouldn't have known what it was. And, you know, often the author will get up and say, this bill, you know, renamed X bridge somewhere. And then, but at the bottom of it, it says something completely different. I mean, and they don't talk about what they added to it. So I'm almost sure that there's some of that, but I think the slowing down of the process in the House probably cut into that a little bit.
Well, stay tuned. James, thank you so much for joining us. There'll be plenty more to talk about. Bill signing period ends August 5th. So between now and August 5th, the governor will be signing dozens of bills into law, and then he'll make the decision of which ones to veto. So there'll be plenty more to talk about and to analyze. And James, you'll be all over it. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Politically Georgia podcast. Head to ajc.com/politics to subscribe to Politically Georgia. You'll get access to our daily newsletter, along with all of our stories and updates on all things Georgia politics. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and rate us. It really means a lot to us when you do. And as always, thank you for listening.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.